Greetings, listeners. Welcome back to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, on this show, we discuss the stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. On each episode, we will have a special guest from the larger podcasting community to help me dive into the issue. Today's guest is an expert on Adam Warlock, Thanos, and all things that rise from the dead. Please welcome the host of Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast, plus a lot of other shows, which are awesome, Al Sedano. Al, how you doing?
I'm good, Sean. Thank you for having me on here. This is cool.
No, this is awesome. We have recorded together a bunch over the years.
Yes.
I've been on your shows, you've been on my shows, but it's been a while, and I'm super excited to get to talk to you and to get to check in. And in a couple months, because this is going to publish in December, I'm going to be a guest on some episodes of your show. In fact, you want to talk about those? Because I'm super excited about them.
Oh, sure. No, because I'm very excited, too, for many reasons. I have two shows on my feed because I found out that having multiple feeds costs a lot of money. So screw that. I'm cheap, at least when it comes to me. So besides the Resurrections, Adam Warlock, and Thanos podcast, on that feed, there's a second show called That Giffen Show, which is all about the work of Keith Giffen. And you had recently recorded with me a couple episodes covering his miniseries, The Heckler. Unfortunately, the computer that was on died, and I thought I lost it forever. But I was able to get that back enough to get some files off there, including those three files. So they will be the episodes for That Giffen Show coming out starting in February, March, and April. March, April, and May.
That's when they'll be coming out. I'm super excited. I love that mini. I was so excited when you reached out to talk about it. It's pure Giffen madness. It's Giffen on
insane.
Oh my God. It's Giffen writing. It's Giffen on art. And it is, I mean, it really is. It's a completely insane mini. And it was so much fun to talk about.
The Christmas stuff.
Oh,
the Christmas character.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's such a, if you've never read Heckler, you can find it in Discount Binge. You can find it on, I'm pretty sure it's on DC Ultra. You owe it to yourself to read it. You will be completely confused, but in the most fun Giffen, Keith Giffen madness way possible. So
yeah, it doesn't matter if you're confused. Just read it.
Yeah, just keep reading. Well, Al, before we begin, the Fire and Water podcast brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month, and we needed some help running the network and hosting our shows, so we started a Patreon. At certain tiers of support, you can support a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray, Darren Appel, and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/Fire and Water Podcast Network. So, Al, I begin every episode with the same question to my guest, and I'm going to field it to you as well. What's your history with Wonder Woman? How'd you first discover the character?
Well, I'm basically going to be copying most of the other guests' answers because we're more or less the similar age range. It's the late 70s, early 80s reruns of Super Friends and the Linda Carter live-action Wonder Woman show.
Those are
the stuff that I really first encountered her with. Also, at some point in my childhood, I forget exactly how old I was, somewhere between 8 and 11, we had some kind of Wonder Woman coloring book. All I remember in it is that Dr. Cyber was one of the characters in there.
Which is terrifying. I mean, that's a terrifying character to have in a coloring book.
Yeah, this weird, like, metal Darth Vader-like face.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my introduction. You know, as for this series, I wasn't even buying comics. I read some, but I wasn't buying them when this came out. You know, I started reading Marvel in 87, and I didn't start DC until 89. There was a certain movie that came out.
Oh, yep.
Featuring, you know, a bad ear back type character. So I started with his stuff. I tried to read this series around War of the Gods, and it didn't work at that point. Maybe by the time you get up to that, I'll get into it more. But at the time, it didn't work for me. So I actually didn't start reading Wonder Woman until 101 when John Byrne started.
Oh, that was a good jumping on point, actually. I read, you know, this series, obviously, and then, you know, kind of dipped in and out in the later part of George's run, eventually went back and got it all and read it. Dipped out for much of Messner Loeb's run. It didn't really sing for me, even though I've come to appreciate it more later. But I jumped back on with 101. I mean, I still remember that cover of Wonder Woman with the giant hair running at the screen. And that's, you know, she fights Darkseid and, you know, Byrne. Not everything he did was perfect, but I like that run. I think it's underrated. And I really especially like that he made Hippolyta the Wonder Woman of World War II.
Those are one of the two things I really like from his run. That and Cassie Sandsmark, Wonder Girl.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Unassailably, she is. I mean, she's not the best Wonder Girl. Donna Troy, I mean, you can't ever even, you know, like Donna Troy's the Michael Jordan of Wonder Girls. But, you know, if you're going to cast second place, Cassie Sandsmark is amazing. And I loved her in Young Justice. And you know, I really wish they were doing something more with the character today.
That's a lot of characters in that time period. But anyway.
Yeah, that's true. So we are jumping into Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 14, which is titled For the Glory of Gaia. The issue, as always, is plotted and laid out by George Perez, scripted by Len Wein. We've got finished art by Bruce Patterson, letters by John Costanza, colors by Carl Gafford, and edited by the legendary Karen Berger. But listeners, as you know, before we jump into the issue, we have a segment that I like to call the Lasso of Truth, where the guest and I each grab Diana's golden lasso and tell some small, silly truth about ourselves. Now, Al, you're the guest, so why don't you go first?
Really? You're still doing this?
I love this. It's my favorite part of the show.
I mean, yeah, but I listened to episode 13. I heard the lasso of truth that he gave. Okay? How am I supposed to follow that? That was like a combo of like, that was a mashup of like, Goonies and The Wraith and Class of 1984. Okay. It was a mix of like those three things. Maybe a little less bloody than Class of 84, but you know, teacher. I'm supposed to follow that.
And it was a good one.
That brought back so much of my childhood. Like I said, that's why I thought of those movies. I'm like, that's what it's like. That's a mix of that. So speaking of those movies, that brings me to my first secret question.
Oh my God. Oh, wait. Okay. Mine. This is a record. I've never had a secret question prior to the Lasso of Truth. So you, my friend, are breaking new ground. This is exciting. So bring it.
Oh, no. Here's the thing. I thought of this secret question the moment he finished talking about that. He finished the story. I'm like, all that popped in my head. I'm like, oh, here's my secret question. Okay. So I know those movies. I don't know if you know all those movies.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I know those movies because I'm old and I grew up in that time, late 80s, early 90s. I was like, early teen, and there was no streaming services.
Nope.
No, we barely had cable half the time. But what we did have, of course, which I'm sure everyone did, were like, besides the regular channels, the ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, we had like the local affiliate stations. For me, it was out of New York, WPIX 11 and WWOR Channel 9. And of course, they would have their syndicate, you know, those bad syndicated shows that they would have.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that's all. I mean, to be fair, I'm not saying bad, but, you know, Star Trek was on Next Generation and Deep Space Nine were the syndicated shows. I remember, like, they came from outer space and a couple other crappy things. But they also would play movies, usually whatever they probably could get cheap because they played them a lot. And at that time, since it's not like we could just stream what we wanted to watch and binge it, you kind of watched whatever was on if you wanted to watch TV. And so these bad movies, I've watched a lot at that time period because that's what was on. And so like when I think about that kind of stuff, some of those movies pop out a lot to me. So my question for you is, did you have that kind of experience too? And if so, which one of those bad movies first pops out of your head is like, I watched this crappy movie, which I probably would not have watched if I had a choice. But it was on so much, I just watched it over and over and over again. So I know it by heart. For me, the two that pop out of my head the most, I'll answer first to give you a chance. Return of the Living Dead Part 2.
Nice.
With talking zombies, begging his girlfriend, let him eat his brains because they smell so good. And the Michael Jackson zombie when they're electrocuting them at the end. The guy dressed like Michael Jackson in the red leather outfit.
I forgot about that. That's awesome.
And of course, the bad horror movie, The Gate.
Oh,
where they opened the gate to hell because they played a heavy metal record backwards.
Those are two inspired choices. First of all, this is a great secret question. This is truly a great secret question. Yeah, Alex, in the last episode, told a very funny story about ghostbusting and demonic gangs. And I mean, he grew up in a small town in the desert, middle of the desert. It makes sense. But this is a great question. A couple of movies jumped out at me. Now, we did have cable because we had a hot cable box, like everybody I knew at that time. We'd, you know, you pay the cable guy to come out $50 and he sets up your cable box and you get the normal channels and you pay monthly for that, but he rigs it so you get everything else, HBO and, you know, everything being, you know, HBO and Showtime at the time. And HBO was a fledgling network at the time. And I truly believe only owned three movies. And these three movies were in rotation 24 hours a day. They were Gotcha, featuring a young Anthony Edwards, pre-Goose in Top Gun and pre-ER.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, Cold War spy movie about a game with darts, like guns that shoot darts on campus that turns into this whole spy drama. Speaking of the Cold War, Cloak and Dagger with Dabney Coleman.
Yeah, one was on the channels a lot. I remember that one.
Oh, yeah. And I think the kid who played Elliot in E.T. actually as well was the little boy in it. But the one that jumps out the most, because I saw this movie so many times, and I am, in my mind, legitimately convinced that it is one of the great movies of the 80s, maybe the great movies of all time. But I also haven't watched it in so long, and it may have just been Stockholm Syndrome. But the first movie that popped into my head was Eddie and the Cruisers, which I don't know if you remember this movie.
Yes.
I mean, everybody remembers the soundtrack, you know, Dark Side. There were some great songs on there. But it is, I mean, it's a Jim Morrison pastiche where Eddie and the Cruisers were this big band, and then Eddie, you know, hates fame and hates success as they get it, and he just disappears one day, and everybody thinks he dies in a car accident, but the band members all try to find him again in the 80s, and it turns out maybe he is alive and he's working like a construction job. It is, I love this damn movie so much, and I still remember it so much, and I must have watched it, I don't know, 100, 200 times when I was a kid. So yeah. I have a little follow-up question for you.
Okay.
In the 80s and in the early 90s, they would show movies on syndicated television on like Friday nights. It was like movie night or whatever at times. And they would just show movies. They would edit them. But like, I remember watching Porky's on just normal syndicated TV, and it was edited, but there's only so much you can edit a movie like Porky's without it still being super, super raunchy. Do you remember any specific movie you watched only in edited form for years?
I mean, I did see this movie first unedited, but I remember catching it once on TV, going to try and figure out what the hell were they thinking, because they had Blazing Saddles.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, how? You just have to edit the 90% of the movie.
I mean, that's like, again, Porky's, which is about a bunch of high school kids going to a whorehouse to lose their virginity. And I mean, that the entire movie, it's like some rap songs, then they try to play them on the radio, and it's just one bleep after another. it's crazy what they used to show on TV.
Actually,
and that is,
I think I might have seen Porky's 2 that way.
Yeah, yeah.
The next day.
Also a great movie. Those are two really, really underrated, raunchy, rated R 80s comedies.
You want to rate their tallywhackers?
I love that The Office spoofs that moment, you know, 30 years later, 20 years later. Well, that is a great secret question. It's so funny. I was like, wait, how do you have a secret question already? But it makes total sense because it's playing on Alex's Lasso of Truth moment from the last episode. But speaking of that.
Oh, yeah, I guess I do have to give something.
Yeah, your Lasso of Truth moment. You haven't shared it with us yet.
Yes. Okay, so here's my Lasso of Truth. So when I was in elementary school, my mother entered me in some kind of tap dancing class. I'm not sure. I don't know whether it was through the school or out of the school. I have no clue. I don't remember. I was like 7. But I was pulled out of it after less than a year, basically due to family pressure. Aww. Probably because it wasn't, quote unquote, manly enough. I mean, we are talking like 82, 83.
Yeah, that sucks, so, though. That would have been a fun class.
I mean, I was good enough to be the lead in the one recital I was in. Now, I have no idea if I was actually good or I was just good compared to other unknowing 6 to 8 year olds. Or maybe it's because I was the only one willing to wear the mask, because this lets me know what year it was at. The lead was basically a very a recital tap version of E.T.
Oh, my God.
I wore an E.T. mask. So maybe I was the only one willing to wear the mask. Who knows? I don't know. I was 7. I just did what I was told.
Okay. A tap dance version of E.T. sounds like the worst best thing of all time. Like, I can't even imagine all of you guys tapping, like, phone home, tap, tap, phone home, tap, tap. That's amazing.
Don't ask me any details about it. That's pretty much everything I remember.
That is awesome. That is really cool. I mean, look, it kind of makes sense, right? Early 80s, Gregory Hines, you know, was really famous. And, you know, it's Running Scared.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that makes sense.
I mean, Gregory Hines is cool. I would have been cool, fine with, like, okay, can I be like Gregory Hines? Or if I can be a quarter as cool as him, I'd be happy.
I mean, look, my wife is from New York. She's from Queens. And we met in college in Arizona, and then she went back to New York after she graduated for a little bit. And I went out to visit her, and I'd never been to the East Coast before. And so we went into the city and we were like, let's go to a show. And we got tickets to Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk, which was an amazing tap show at the time. So I'm a big fan. I mean, that's pretty cool. That's awesome. I am also going to tell a story about kids, but not me as a kid, but instead from when I was a teacher. And so I'm going to grab Diana's lasso. And I'm going to admit that when I was teaching, I had a set of twins and I had probably... Over the course of, I mean, I taught for 15 years. I probably had 6 to 7 sets of twins in my career. But this set in particular, it was Kelsey and Christy, and I'm changing their names a little bit, but they were identical in a way that was like Black Mirror. Like they were not only identical, they had the exact same haircut. They dressed exactly the same. They spoke the same. They had the exact same braces. I mean, these kids were impossible to tell apart. Now, usually what schools do is they separate twins in different classes. So that way the kids have their own identities and the teachers can kind of get to know them. And the kids, they don't feel like they're always a twin. But in this case, I was teaching an honors English class and I was the only honors English teacher for this grade level. So they were both honors kids and they were both in my room. And I went, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, I at no point during the year could tell them apart. And usually, you know, by a certain point, I would figure some little clue out. Well, at one point, really shamefully late in the year, like January or something, I'm talking to one of them and I call her Christy and she's like, no, I'm Kelsey. And I'm like, well, and they're like, Mr. Ross, why can't you get us straight by now? Like, you've had us for, you know, half a year, you should be able to figure this out. And in loving frustration, so this was totally joking, I had a great relationship with these girls, so it was not anything I knew it wouldn't offend them. I go, you guys can't get mad at me. I go, you're identical. It's impossible to tell you guys apart. I said, I bet you your parents couldn't even tell you apart as kids. I bet you at one point in life, Kelsey, you were Christy, and Christy, you were Kelsey, and your parents mixed you up at some point. You've gone back and forth between those identities. I said, I bet you anything that's happened. So don't get mad at me for not figuring you out. And they laughed and everything, and I laughed. And again, very lovingly, jokingly. Yeah. Well, I did not realize they were going to go home and tell their parents, oh, haha, you know how Mr. Ross is really funny. He said to us today that we probably each have changed identities over the course of our lives because you guys have mixed us up. Well, they come back the next day and they're like, Mr. Ross, we have to tell you something. And I'm like, all right, what's up? They're like, you know how yesterday you told us our parents have probably mixed us up? And I go, oh, yeah, hi. You know, I was just kidding. They go, no, we went home and we told our parents because we thought it was really funny. And our dad totally admitted to us that it absolutely happened and that there were many times when it was just him watching us and that our mom would come home and she'd be like, wait, did you put Kelsey? And he's like, I don't know. I just don't know. And so they're like, I like shook them to the core of their identities. They both had like, they're like, what if we started out as the other? And what if I've been Christy and I've been Kelsey? And I was like, oh my God, you guys, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to give you an existential crisis at this young an age. And so they were really good about it. Super sweet kids. But the next year, when I had them, I had sophomores too, Kelsey, one of the two of them, completely chopped and dyed her hair. And like went off, went rogue and like broke the twin pact so that everybody could tell them apart. And I was like, thank you so much. Even though Christy was really upset, I was so thankful for Kelsey for doing that. So yeah, I inadvertently caused existential soul crisis in a couple of kids as ninth graders.
You will live forever with their therapists.
Oh yeah. 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 And I felt so bad. I really, and they were laughing about it and they were really funny about it, but I was like, I can't believe your dad admitted that. They're like, we couldn't either. And I was like, oh my God. So.
Oh, this is the origin of Fenris, isn't it?
Oh my God. Oh yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. That is their villain origin story. That's a good point. So that brings us to the end of the Lasso of Truth. So up next, we're going to jump into the issue itself and I'll provide a brief summary. So this is, again, Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 14, and the Challenge of the Gods is done. It wrapped up in the last issue with Diana and Hippolyta seemingly rescuing Heracles, but with Hermes saying to Diana that she had to go kill the manhunter that impersonated his son, Pan. So that takes us to Millennium, Issue 7, where Pan brings about his own destruction. There is no need to go read Millennium Number 7. For the love of God, save yourself. Do not read Millennium. It is a wonderful idea that does not come anywhere near its potential in execution. But Diana flashes, George and Len are smart. They have her flash away and they have her flash back. And she flashes back right away into the Hellmouth under Themyscira, where Heracles is holding up the entire island and protecting Hippolyta, who lies unconscious next to him. Diana flies in, takes Hippolyta away to safety, but flies back, even against the wishes of Hercules, who said for her to save herself, telling him, no, if you're holding up this island protecting my sisters, I will hold it up with you. I will not leave you to suffer alone. He's amazed by this, considering the horrors that he inflicted upon her Amazon sisters and her own mother. Now, Zeus sees this, and he sees both of them willing to sacrifice themselves, and he sees the nobility in this moment, and he frees both of them, having the power of Gaia hold the island up from this point forward. Diana rescues Heracles, bringing him to paradise, up to Paradise Island, where he makes an earnest apology to the Amazons, humbling himself before them, apologizing for the previous horrible actions he inflicted upon them. They forgive him. He's exalted. There is much rejoicing. And then the Amazons celebrate. The gods make love. Heracles returns to Olympus, and Hippolyta sends Diana back to man's world to prepare them for the coming of the Amazons. So let's jump into the issue, Alan. Let's start at the cover. What are your thoughts? Why don't you describe it for the listeners and tell us your thoughts on this cover?
Okay. So the cover is a scene taking place on Paradise Island, and we have a whole mess load of Amazons standing there. Some are playing musical instruments. Most of them are just smiling and looking up, including Heracles, as Diana is basically leaping up for joy, more or less, above them. And it's kind of amazing, but it also makes sense because it's Perez, that Diana is so large and prominent on the cover, but yet we have so many other characters here, and they're all distinct individual characters. You can even if they don't have names, we don't know the names of them, you could tell which each one is and what they're doing, what they're doing and where they're looking even. It's amazing. It also kind of lets you know what kind of story you expect inside. It's like, oh, look, this is the happy celebration issue. It's a nice transit. It tells you like, hey, this is a transition issue between stories. If you want to pick this up, this might be a good spot.
Yeah, I love this cover. I will say it may not be the best cover in the series, but it is one of my favorites. And it's one of the covers I think about when I think about this run, because it is... it's like a beautifully done photo, like a snapshot caught right in a moment of exaltation and everybody, all these Amazons, and George is like so extra, because the pose of Diana against this beautiful blue sky and the white columns, it's all very, very Greece, right? Very white and blue.
God, yeah.
And Diana in joy, like kind of lifting herself to the sky, but looking at her mother and smiling and seeing the celebration around her. Like, that would have been enough. Hippolyta and Heracles and a couple of Amazons, that would have been enough. But if you look down below Diana on this, there is a literal crowd of Amazons stretching all the way back from the foreground to the background. I mean, I can't even imagine how long it took the man to draw this cover, but it is a complete moment. And it really does completely capture the spirit of this issue. And I think actually the spirit of this book, I mean, if you asked me, what is the like visual metaphor for this first 14 issues of this book? Like, what is the thesis statement? I think I'd probably put this cover on it, because it is the joyous resolution of the first year plus of this book. And then in particular, as we'll talk about as we dive into the issue, it speaks to the power of quote Huey Lewis, the power of love, the power of the Amazon. So I love this mm-hmm. cover. It's a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah, and you're right, because like there's about, I counted while you're saying about how many there were. There's about at least 38 individual Amazons.
It's crazy.
Not counting her mother, Diana, her mother, or Heracles. And you're right about the whole snapshot thing, because it almost looks like the part where like her mother, the queen is addressing everybody and saying, Diana, daughter, come up here. And she's literally jumping up to join them.
Yeah.
And like someone happened to have a camera and took a picture at that exact moment as she's jumping up to join.
Yeah, it's mid-leap. And George even took the time to draw like all the chest hair on Heracles. I mean, it is unbelievable the level of detail in this cover. It is a piece of art. I mean, it really is. And I love it, because again, this is maybe my two favorite issues in this whole run. And the cover does it justice, and it speaks to what's to come, which is so amazing. And so I love this cover so much, and I love that the cover is both story-wise, but also emotionally really indicative of what's coming into the book. So let's actually jump into the book And let's talk about the opening, which is Diana returning from Millennium. And again, George and Len, if you could just cut the Millennium of it all out of this, this 14 issues would make a perfect standalone story. It'd be a perfect one of those little DC, you know, those DC Digests they have now?
Yeah.
The smaller, like novel-sized books, which are awesome. This would be a perfect version of that. You know, and I guess you could just put up with the Millennium of it all, but if you could cut it out, it would be great. It wouldn't be hard because it's not much, but Diana, you know, returns from Millennium. Hermes sweeps her back. And that picture, I'm going to talk about this panel later, the third panel on that first page, she's eyes open, mouth agape, because she sees Heracles holding up the entire island, protecting his mother. And it's a really, you know, very sort of Atlas holding up the world moment. And he's, you know, he tells her, hey, this is fitting punishment for what I did to your people. Leave me and protect your mom. And I'm curious, this whole opening, you know, she sweeps Hippolyta away, but then flies back, offers to hold the island up with Heracles. And then they're saved by Zeus because he says, no, I'll do it. What are your thoughts on him in this moment? Because this is a very different portrayal than the last time we saw this character in issue one.
Oh, this is definitely Heracles trying to make up for everything he's done. Because going through the jump ahead to the whole issue, but I mean, you already gave the synopsis, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. I was waiting the entire time for the villain turn. I was waiting, especially at the point later on, towards the end, before he leaves, when he's alone with the queen.
Uh-huh.
I was expecting him to do something horrible, or at least to snicker and think of something horrible, that this is part of some, he's going to get back at her. He's going, you know, he's going to get revenge. I up until the very end, I'm like, I was actually surprised. I'm like, wow. But it makes sense. I mean, because otherwise, basically, they're saying, if he does that, they're basically saying the Amazon way doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that kind of defeats the entire purpose of the series.
Well, and I love that you say that, because I was waiting for that moment, too, because he is so horrible. And what he does is so violent and, I think, unforgivable in issue one. But the Amazons prove to be better people than I am. And I struggle this whole issue with his redemption, and I kept waiting for that moment too. And I'm so glad it didn't come, because you're right. The fact that he's earnest is because of the Amazons, and shows that their way of life is right. This like focus on love and forgiveness and redemption, the possibility of redemption for any man, even Heracles, you know, is available and is possible. And so it's amazing, because, you know, Zeus even comes to them under Themyscira, and he says, I've learned my lesson. Because remember, the whole challenge of the gods was prompted by him attempting to assault Diana. And, you know, he's talked out of it by the gods and eventually learns his lesson over the course of this arc. And he says to them, you know, Heracles, not only have you learned, I've learned as well. We're both different people. And I'm going to show you that by saving you both. Now, he doesn't, you know, Zeus's version of saving them is not exactly like, oh, hey, let me hit pause on these rocks falling for a moment so you can get away safely. It's more like, oh, I'll save you guys and have Gaia hold the island up, and then like blink and the island is falling on top of them. So, you know, maybe not.
I'm going to save you. Yeah. Run.
Yeah, exactly. Save might be a strong verb, but, you know, they do
this
escape.
This is about as good as Zeus gets ever anyway. I mean, honestly, Zeus is pretty good in this issue too. Yeah, it's like, and it's all his fault. I mean, him and Pan, which, by the way, I understand what you're saying about the whole Millennium of it all, but it would have been nice to have some, at least a editor's note saying where to go. Cause like,
yeah,
the Pan thing is pretty decent though. Like in the series, like what's going on with Pan? Pan's the one that's, you know, manipulating Zeus into like doing all this. Pan's involved in it. And then like the whole Pan thing is resolved off panel. I mean, like you said before, we probably could do the whole thing in like a digest, but I think it would have to be an extra issue, because we'd have to have an issue dealing with what Pan's plan is then, if he's not a manhunter.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, that's the only issue problem with that, is like, it kind of like this whole plot thread was like, yeah, go away. It's over there. Don't worry. We're not going to be able to hear it all.
Pay no attention to the goat man in the corner.
It's like, but what happened?
It really is. They do cake it over pretty quickly. And I don't blame them, because it sucks that it interrupted this arc that they've been building to since literally issue one. You know, but it's I get it. It's part of doing monthly comics at one of the big two.
It's so, what you do. You have to deal with it. You're going to have, for every Infinity Gauntlet or Crisis, there's going to be, you know, a Millennium.
Exactly.
Or a Genesis.
Oh, God, yeah. I covered that on DC OCD with Paul Hicks and Peter Rios, actually. And it was, No, it was just Paul Hicks. Genesis is as bad as Millennium is. I had to reread Genesis, and it's literally unreadable. I read it multiple times, and I still could not tell you at all what it was about or who the major story. I mean, it's definitely the worst of the worst.
By the way, speaking of Peter Riros, real quick, on his Legion Project show, he was talking about doing reads of Millennium and Legends, and he said rereading them, he likes Millennium better.
No. Oh, I can't. I have so much respect for Peter as a person and podcaster, and I can't even imagine a world where that's true. The idea of Millennium is great, and the idea of these imposters everywhere, like a la Secret Invasion, is really cool, but oh no. I mean, oh God. Okay, I need to recover for a minute.
But back to the Zeus question. Yeah, this is as good as Zeus gets, but Zeus does not last long ever, at
No.
least historically. So even though I don't know what's going to happen next, because like I said, the next issues of this series I read were around War of the Gods. So I'm assuming there should be a count or something of like, how long before Zeus is a dick?
Well, and the
Or
truth
actually, yeah.
is, that is the nature of Greek mythology, right? They're horrible, horrible people. And it's funny to watch Diana and the Amazons live in this religious system where they worship these gods and they're at the, they serve at the behest of these gods who are inherently not always particularly great people or exemplars of how you should behave. And so it is funny to watch that tension and Zeus is, and Heracles, chief amongst those characters. And so she wicks Heracles away and they land. I love page seven, panel one, two, three, four, five, six. She's holding Hercules like a big hairy man baby. It's
Yes.
amazing.
Oh God, that is so disturbing.
It is so, it is almost pornographic. I don't know why I mean, they're both clothed, but there is like a, I don't know, an animalistic nature to the way Paris draws Heracles.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Heracles is just basically, he's not even wearing like the Greek equivalent, what we would call like looking like a diaper. It's just like a thong. Okay? He is wearing, he is. This is what the thong song is based on. He is wearing that, and the way she's holding him, you barely can see it. And I mean, let's face it, Wonder Woman's costume is basically a bathing suit with, one piece bathing suit with strapless one with boots. And with her holding him, you barely see any of her costume. So yeah, they basically do look naked.
It does, and the shock of it is because the Amazons see her holding Heracles, and last time they saw him, he was leading a violent assault on them, and he's like, wait, 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 and so the way if you just look at the image, it looks like they were doing some crazy role play, and like their kids walked in on them or something. Like it is definitely, I
Oh,
mean,
God.
God bless Perez because he draws the heck out of this, and yeah, and then Heracles has this incredible moment. Where they show Perez and Patterson show his foot descending from where Diana's holding him to touch Paradise Island to apologize. And I know this reminded you of something, right? Because this it did me too, but yeah, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about this.
So, like I said, I wasn't buying comics at this point, but I had family members who, like, I had an uncle who worked something involving recycling, quote unquote. Italian guy from New Jersey, New York,
Wait, waste
maybe.
management?
Yeah, I don't. There's other stories I can tell you off mic that I heard about apparently. But anyway, he had a bunch of comics. His only interest in them was selling ones that were worth money. But anything that he had doubles of that he didn't think was worth something, I could take. And I just like reading stuff, so I'm like, great. So one of the early comics I had to read was like New Teen Titans 13, the first series. And it's a whole thing with like, while the main Titans were trying to fight somebody, I forget who, Wonder Girl and Starfire were on Paradise Island. This is pre-crisis, of course, because Beast Boy, Changeling, was injured fighting Deathstroke, I believe, and they were trying to use the Purple Ray or whatever. But the big issue was like, we can't have him touch the ground because, no man can step foot on Paradise Island. And that's also by drawn by Perez. And that's in my head. And as I'm looking at this, I'm going, oh, okay, I guess that's our first clue that there's a made this is one of the clues that there's a major change between this and pre-crisis.
Yeah, I love that you drew attention to this. And Perez does too, because again, we get panel by panel of Heracles' foot descending and then flat on the ground. And that would only mean something to readers who knew the pre-Crisis mythology. Because according to pre-Crisis mythology, if a man sets foot on Themyscira, the Amazons lose their power. You know, they lose their immortality. They lose their power forever. And so him setting foot and it not doing that really does show you, hey, this is a new, you know, version of this. This is post-Crisis. I mean, and you could kind of logic it away. You could say, well, he's a demigod. You know, he's not actually a man. But it doesn't matter. They're brightlining it, saying, no.
Yeah.
This is new. And this is him. And we have new rules here, which is going to open up eventually Themyscira to the whole world, which is really, really interesting. So the only reason the Amazons allow him to speak is because Hippolytus has let him speak. And he humbles himself before them. He says to them, hey, I was driven by madness, which is actually true. In mythology, Hera had made him mad, insane. Still, though, doesn't excuse what he did. And he humbles himself. He says, you didn't deserve what I did to you. I don't deserve your forgiveness, but I beg of your forgiveness. I betrayed you. That's unforgivable. And they're so astounded by this demigod, you know, humbling himself, that they actually like say, hail Hercules, you know, hail the power of Gaia. So this brings me to my first secret question. So in this issue, Heracles humbles himself before the Amazons and is forgiven. For a modern audience, that is tough to accept given his crime. What is the farthest you've ever gone with some mental gymnastics to forgive a character you love for a misdeed? And I'll go first. I'll give you some time to think.
Okay.
So for me, and anybody who's followed my shows over the years knows this, I'm a major Hank Pym fan. I first encountered Hank in the Avengers after his breakdown. So I first encountered him like with tension with Jan, but, you know, kind of a loving tension. I didn't know the past. I didn't know the whole striking her thing. And then most importantly, I really got to know him as a character in West Coast Avengers, where he shows up and he serves as like the team scientist, basically, and then eventually, you know, redeems himself, becomes Dr. Pym after a suicide attempt, and then becomes a hero. And I have always really loved him. I partially because of my own, you know, parental history with my dad, but I don't know what it is, but there's something about a flawed man who works really hard to redeem himself that is always a soft point for me in a story. Now, eventually I went back and got the back issues and I saw when he strikes Jan. And I like that later writers have tried to say, hey, look, he was in the middle of a mental breakdown. Like, he was literally breaking down when this happened. It doesn't excuse it, but there's more context. And then, of course, there's the Jim Shooter story that he wrote the issue where Hank Pym strikes Janet Pym. And he only wrote Hank, like, pushes her away. And Bob Hall, who drew the issue, draws it as an actual strike. Now, I've also read interviews with Bob Hall where Bob Hall's like, Jim's full of crap. You know, rest in peace, Jim. But he's like, Jim's full of crap. The script said what it said. So, you know, who knows? And it doesn't really matter. But I think Hank Pym has done enough in the Marvel Universe to sort of have redeemed himself. And Jan even forgives him several times over the decades. And, you know, again, it's not an easy thing because what he did is horrible. But it's kind of one of those things, like I like the character so much that I liked his redemption arc, and I kind of wish he were no longer defined by that one act, though I do get it. What about you?
I have a thought on that, but first, something you said. So yeah, we have to remember, there is a difference between explanation and excuse.
Yes, yeah.
There could be explanations, like you said. You know, it doesn't mean they should be excused, but there can be explanations. Like Hercules, like you said about the gods, they're always jerky, but to be fair, Hercules usually is the most jerkiest. Not always, but usually the most jerkiest when he's being driven mad by the gods, when they're actually driving him insane.
Yeah.
Not always an excuse, but an explanation, which is better than, you know, characters who just do it because they want to do it. And with Hank Pym, unfortunately, it seems like most writers want to do that story over and over again. So they just keep dredging it up. It's kind of like Batman's a jerk. Batman's a jerk. Batman learns how to not be so much of a jerk to his own team. You know, it's like his family. And then we go back to, look, Batman's a jerk. Batman's a jerk. Batman alert. Eventually, it's like, oh, okay, enough. But, you know, they like writing those stories. So whatever. But anyway, for me, it's a character who's a little less redeemable, but it doesn't matter. Have you ever watched Supernatural?
I have, yeah. I didn't watch all 50 seasons or whatever, however long it ran, but I did watch the early seasons, yes.
Yeah, it's actually, my wife's in the other room watching it right now before it goes away from Netflix on the 7th in December. But Crowley.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The character Crowley, the demon, he's a demon, so he's not a good guy anyway. And he eventually becomes the king of hell. So he's definitely in charge of things. And he does a lot of horrible things. He causes the death of some characters. He tortures characters. But he's just so much fun. He's just so enjoyable. He's just so snarky that it's like, oh, you little, I know you killed this person and you're torturing Kevin's mother for years, but it, oh, come on, I can't get say mad at you, you lovable scamp. Get over here. Call him a squirrel again. Come on, call the moose and squirrel again. It'll be okay. And it's just like, okay, you know what? You're just too much fun. I have to just deal with the fact that you've done horrible, horrible things.
Yeah, those characters are so. I mean, it's like John Constantine, right? Like John Constantine is a horrible, horrible person. He is. If you are friends with John Constantine, you will get sacrificed and sent to hell at some point. It's just, it's done. Even if you just drive a cab for him, like Chaz, you're going to end up
screwed.
Yeah, you're going to end up meeting a grisly, grisly end. It's always the way, and yet, you know, he's just so lovable.
It's just about the, I don't know, maybe it's the British snarky, because we're so used to like the posh, you know, keep it all together British, you know, stiff upper lip. And so when you get to characters like Constantine or Crowley, who has a British accent, or even, you know, Spike from Buffy, you know, it's like, I know you killed those characters I love, but oh, you're just too fun.
It is always fun to root for those characters. That's a good choice. That's a really good choice. I mean, his name's Crowley, so you know from the beginning, you know, not gonna end well, but you know, still. Yeah. It's funny, I liked that show and I watched it in the early days and then fell away from it. I think just because it was hard for me to keep up with it. It was on like a night, I don't know what was going on, but it was just on a night where I had trouble watching it or something. And then had no idea it was still on. And then like a decade later, somebody was like, oh, I want to watch the finale of Supernatural. And I'm like, Supernatural? And I had no idea that show ran as long as it did. It's like Grey's Anatomy. Like that show is still on. It's like in its, I don't know, maybe its 20th year at this point, if not more.
Yes.
The character Meredith Grey, for who it's named, is gone and it's still running. And it's like, oh my God, like it is shocking how long shows last sometimes. Yeah, it's, but I like both. I like Jensen Ackles and yeah, it was a good show. So we cut from Celebration on Themyscira up to Olympus and sort of as below, so above. The gods are like, okay, this is awesome. This is a time for celebration. Zeus has come around and let go of the madness that Pan had spoken into his ear. I mean, I think we're letting Zeus off a little lightly here. Hera even says to him, you know, wow, I'm finding you attractive again. And he's like, well, let's go make godly love. And then Aphrodite, not so subtly at all, is like, hey, Athena, it's time for lovemaking. Everybody should be making love. Let's all. And it's funny because it sets the tone where the gods are all, you know, hey, let's rejoice in carnal delight. You assume the same thing is happening on Themyscira with the Amazons. And then we get to, it's like, well, not just in Olympus, not just Paradise Island. We cut to an attic in Oklahoma, you know, maybe right next to Clinton Robinson's house. And so Etta, Aunt Candy, and Steve Trevor are there. And as a reminder, Steve had gone back home to Oklahoma to see his dad, who was ill. His dad passed away. So Steve is up in his aunt's attic, sort of just going through old photos. And he's, you know, really doubting himself and he's questioning himself. And Etta climbs up to the attic to see him. And she's like, look, you know, you're the best man I've ever known. And I'm just going to make this confession. I love you. And he's like, Etta, I love you. And then we get a pretty pretty graphic little panel there of the two of them. I mean, there's no question as to what is happening on that attic, in that attic. And, you know, I do wonder. Yeah. And I do wonder, like, you know, Steve, Etta literally says, Steve, your aunt's finishing dinner. It's time to come down and eat. And that poor aunt is probably in the kitchen and is like, what is all that racket coming from the attic? And is like, oh, my, you know, adult nephew is getting it on with this woman he brought to my house for his dad's funeral. So, you know, maybe not the most tasteful thing ever, but, you know, good for them.
So real quick then, before we go further. So first of all, the gods are celebrating, which is great, which is fine, which makes sense. That's what they do. They cause problems and they drink and, you know, have orgies. It's Greek gods. It's what they do.
It is.
But they're celebrating because Diana and Heracles have finished their labors, basically. You know, that's why Zeus said you were, you know, you've done well. That's why the whole thing of I'm going to have Gaia hold up the island. So here's the thing. Here's a secret question. because they both finished their labors given to them by the gods. So if the gods had to give you some kind of trial, now,
ooh,
let's just assume we're not doing physical fighting minotaurs and cleaning out this, you know, the stables like them. But what is the hardest trial that you could think of that you would have to be given by the gods?
That's,
you know, personally,
such a good question. Go first, because I want to think.
It's only fair. It's a question. I go first. I would have to give up coffee for a month. And I would probably have to have all the sharp objects in the house taken away. Actually, I would have to have the sharp objects in the house taken away, because if I'm giving up coffee for a month, I don't know if I could live there with my wife drinking coffee. So we have to take it away from her, which means after a day or two, I would better not be sharp objects, because I would be dead.
That's a good answer. I don't drink coffee. I'm a iced tea guy. And I remember my wife, when she was pregnant with our daughter, she gave up coffee, right? And so she gives up coffee and she's like, you know, going to have the baby. She has the baby. And she's like, oh my God, I'm so glad I had the baby. I can't wait till I'm done nursing so I can drink coffee again. And we had her aunt and uncle and a bunch of people were over. And I go, well, wait a minute. I go, you gave up coffee for 9 months at this point. Like, why not just give it up completely? Like, why, you know, you've already done the hardest part. Like, why not just quit? Like, why do you want to start drinking again? And she looks at me completely serious and goes, to make up for all the coffee I missed during the pregnancy. And I was like, oh my God. And everybody in the room was like, uh-huh. And they all shook their heads. I was like, okay, clearly this is something I don't understand. Cause yeah.
Yeah. No, I like her. Yeah. I like her. Yeah. No, ask Clinton. He's seen pictures of my coffee setup.
Oh my God. That's so funny. So this is great.
He's impressed by it.
That's impressive. Clinton knows his coffee. This
I
is
have
a
multiple
great
machines.
Question. Oh my gosh. This is a really great question. So yeah, I definitely, the hardest trial for me would be, I'm very extroverted professionally. So you have to be a teacher and, you know, to be kind mm-hmm. of an education and the jobs that I've had, I'm very extroverted professionally, but I am very introverted personally. So I am very much somebody who, after a day of dealing with a ton of people, especially when I was in the classroom, you know, dealing with 150, 160 kids a day, I would have to come home and really isolate myself and really get some like deep, deep quiet time and reading and just, you know, no noise, not surrounded by anybody, not talking to people, not, you know, kind of anything like that. Nobody needing anything from me for a little bit. And so I'm kind of subscribing to Jean-Paul Sartre from No Exit here and Hell Is Other People. My trial would be if I were surrounded by people all day, every day. I just couldn't. If I never got any alone time, any isolated time, I would lose my mind and I would be unlivable. I would be such a curmudgeon that I would be like you without coffee, basically. So yeah, that's a good question, man. That's a good trial.
That's a rough one.
Yeah, and actually, I'm going to piggyback it because I have a secret question too. So We get a lot of love making. We get a lot of characters doing a little dance, making a little love, getting down. And, you know, we get it on Olympus, we get it on Themyscira, we get it in the attic in Oklahoma. So my secret question is, in any media, so it can be any sort of fiction, movie, TV, anything, do you have a favorite example of two characters getting together physically, kind of either finally getting together physically or what it means for them to get together physically? And since I asked it, I'll go first. I'm a huge fan. I don't know if you've ever read the novel Atonement by Ian McEwan. Came out in 2001. They made a movie of it not long after. Keira Knightley and is in it. She's the main character. James McAvoy is the other main character. It is, I think, one of the five best novels ever written. It is it's an amazing story, and it's just beautifully written. But these two characters, Robbie and Cecilia, they grow up. Cecilia is the daughter of the wealthy sort of family, and Robbie is the son of one of the people who helps care for the home. But Cecilia and Robbie sort of know each other as they grow up. They're the similar age. And even though socially it's sort of forbidden, he is madly in love with her, and he's writing her these like very intense love notes that he never intends to give to her, but she accidentally gets them. And instead of being horrified by them the way he thinks she will be, it really awakens something in her. And they have this incredibly passionate first time together in a library. It's a pretty famous scene in the movie, actually. And it is, I mean, just passionate and raw and really powerful. And it sets the tone for the entire book, because this physical act is witnessed by Bryony, who is Cecilia's little sister, who misinterprets the act. And it sets off the sort of MacGuffin for the whole book. And so it is, but it is such a beautiful scene, and it really shows the power of the connection of these two characters, which you have to believe in order to sustain through the novel. So really my favorite examples. What about you?
I'm trying hard to remember, think of something that I really, that's like coming to mind. I mean, I will say that the description of what happened in Atonement really does kind of sound like a much more romantic, you know, quote unquote romantic version of, you know, the Wesley and Buttercup from
They're perfect example. Yeah.
But so I'm not going to go with the first time I actually remember giving a damn about that kind of thing, you know, because obviously as a little kid, you don't care about the romantic stuff. I mean, I remember watching the original Superman movie when it was on TV the first time I saw it. And I'm like, I don't care about the thing with Lois. When's he going to fight stuff? You know, I wanted to see, when's he going to go against Luther? Come on, let Superman do things. So the first time I gave a damn about that, I'm 5 years old and I am watching The Empire Strikes Back as it came out in the theaters.
Perfect.
And Han and Leia getting together, and Han, like, I could even tell they're interested in each other, and she's playing it off, and then they kiss. And then of course the climactic, you know, part on the Cloud City where, you know, he's about to be frozen and she says, I love you. And he's like, I know. And like, that is the first time I can remember actually caring about that kind of thing. So yeah, that's the one I'm going to go with, because that's the first one that I actually was like, oh, I get this.
I mean, it's a perfect example. It is. And I think it imprinted on all of us, right? All of us, especially boys of a certain age, but I think everybody of a certain age. I mean, that, you know, Han Solo is that the ultimate response, you know, the I know is so cool. And, you know, and it's the relationship, you know, that's at the heart of that whole series, really, for most people. That's a great choice. And so, speaking of love, and maybe in an odd way, because I don't know how I feel about this, and I'm actually really kind of curious to hear from you. So again, everybody's celebrating, and Hippolyta is healing, and the Amazons are actually melting their armor and their weapons, because they're like, well, this is now a time of peace. No more of our sisters have to die defending this hellmouth under Paradise Island. And Diana's flying over the island, and she spies Heracles and Hippolyta down by a stream. And Heracles asks Hippolyta, you know, he says, hey, your daughter's really majestic and beautiful. He's like, do I see any of me in there? And she's like, no. And he goes, good. He goes, I would hate for something as beautiful as Diana to have come from something as violent as what I did. And then he says, you know, and she says to him, it's so strange to hear you talk so softly. Last time you did was a lie, but now I sense only truth. And they kiss, and they confess their love for each other. Like, he's like, you know, you're still beautiful. And she's like, I'm a woman. It's been a long time. And I super struggle with this scene, considering what happened the last time they met. How do you feel about it? I mean, are you, again, it fits in with Greek mythology, so I get it.
So the thing is, as we're reading this, if you're reading this as it comes out, it's only been about 14 months since you saw Heracles do these horrible things to the Amazon. But from their perspective, it's been, forgive the pun, a millennium or more. So, I mean, time does help. So that's the other thing. It's like, yes, it is part of the Greek god thing. It's also, there's a difference between having a year or 5 years or 20 years, but they've had hundreds and hundreds and like thousands of years to come to deal, you know, to have their own therapy and deal with this. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a right thing, or it's fine, it's been a little while. I'm just saying that's a perspective we can't have, because we don't have thousands of years where we live eternally young.
No, that is a super important perspective, that it really has been centuries for them to process. And then also, again, they live within this paradigm. They live within the structure of a religion that believes in the Greek gods and follows the Greek gods. So they're part of their own stories, are stories like this. And the gods kind of are just different and are treated differently. And again, neither one of us is saying it's okay. But I can, you know, I can see why we're struggling with it as a modern audience, but I can see why George and Len made that choice. And so Heracles kisses Hippolyta goodbye, and he's taken up to Olympus, and it's kind of an end of a story for him for now. You know, I don't think we're done with Heracles.
It didn't seem like it.
No, no.
Oh, and also one other thing I just thought of, it's part of the whole Amazon way. I mean, this is their way of forgiveness and love. Like I said before, when I said I was expecting the villain turn from him, because they can't do, if they did that, they're kind of saying the Amazon way is wrong. So it's also their way that to forgive eventually, even if it's not forgetting, maybe they'll forgive it, because if not, what are they doing? Then they're just being like the rest of all of us in Man's World.
Yeah, and this is, I'm so glad you brought that up, because this is the ultimate example of that. This is this issue and that moment of Hippolyta, Diana, and all the Amazons forgiving Heracles, and then also Heracles humbling himself and acknowledging the scope and the horror of what he did, and wanting earnestly to make amends and to, you know, to say that he understands the scope of what he did, and that, you know, he is an ally to them and a friend to them now. It really does prove, and it doesn't, it's really fascinating, because it proves to Heracles, so it's the Amazon way that redeems Heracles. It's the Amazon way that cures Zeus of his madness, bringing peace and love back to Olympus. And it's the Amazon way that shows the power of this comic. If that, you know, 14 issues in, there's no question as to the thesis statement of this comic. There's no question as to what this comic's about. What makes it, and to go back to an earlier episode where Dr. Ange and I were talking about the end of pre-Crisis Wonder Woman, of volume one of Wonder Woman, and Ange said something really interesting. He said, you know, in pre-Crisis, for a lot of folks, Wonder Woman was just female Superman. There really wasn't a huge difference between the two characters. Now there is a marked difference, because Diana is truly an ambassador of the Amazon way, and the Amazon way has been demonstrated over these 14 issues and has been demonstrated to be so powerful that it redeems the horrors of Heracles. It redeems the demon plague of Pandora, you know, that lived under Paradise Island, and even brings sanity to Zeus, at least temporarily, and the gods. So it's a really cool moment. It's a really, really powerful issue. And I love the spirit of it. I love that George and Len take a full issue. This reminds me of a Claremont, like, baseball issue of the X-Men.
Yes.
You know, a quiet moment, or Legion. Paul Levitz does this really well in the Legion. Those, like, sort of quiet times after the big battles. But it's so necessary, because Diana hasn't had a moment's rest, and it's a good moment for the reader to stop and go, oh, this is what makes this book different. This is why, this is what sets this book apart from all the others.
Yes, it's not just, this is a phrase we use on my show, especially when we're talking about the Captain Marvel issues that Jim Starlin was doing in the 70s when he becomes Protector of the Universe and gets cosmic powers. And we basically say, yeah, he says these things, but basically he's still just punching his way to peace.
Yeah.
And this is not this is like the next step. They're not just punching their way to peace. They're actually taking steps to bring peace. You know, I mean, they're not just being doormats. Heracles doesn't go, oh, sorry, my bad, that was wrong, I'm sure that was wrong. He actually, you have to actually be legitimately regretful and remorseful to get that kind of, you know, forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are, they're like, you will get it. You, as long as you are legitimately, truly remorseful.
Yeah. And it's so interesting, because there have been two major arcs in this book thus far. There's the Ares conflict. That's the first six issues. And that conflict is not won by violence. It's won by Wonder Woman showing Ares what he would actually get if he won, the complete destruction of the universe, where he would be alone, and him ending his battle in order to, after realizing the horror he was going to inflict. And then this ends with her and Hippolyta and the Amazons forgiving Heracles and redeeming him and Zeus and all the others. Again, not really so much with violence, but with peace and love, though enough fisticuffs to keep, you know, comic book fan interested in. So
it's still Greek mythology type stuff. So you have punching and fighting. But I mean, you know, what does she do when she encounters Hercules the first time? She doesn't go to hit him for what he did. She's like, I'm going to help you.
Right. She says to him, like, you know, noble one, let me stay here and suffer with you. And he's like, are you crazy? He's like, you know what I did. And she's like, I don't care. I'm not going to let somebody suffer. And it really is what sets her apart. You know, it's great.
I mean, they both know the story of Atlas. They both know Heracles is probably expecting to be standing there forever holding up the island. And she knows that too. So her going to do that with him is not just saying, I'm going to help you for a few minutes. It's basically saying, I'm going to spend eternity here with you holding this up. We're going to share this burden together forever.
Yeah, I'm choosing torment in order to lessen your load, versus freeing myself, even though that's what you want and are telling me to do. And again, it is what distinguishes Diana from every other hero in the Marvel or DC universe. It's that compassion and that love. And she doesn't hit first and ask questions later. She hugs first and then will hit you if she needs to. And when she hits you, she's badass. So, you know, that's yes. A lot of fun too. So it's so awesome because, again, we have all of these sort of these redemption arcs coming to the fore. We have the reunion of Heracles and Hippolyta. We have Zeus and Hera reuniting. And that actually brings me to my last secret question of the episode. So in this issue, Zeus is cured of his madness, which, again, he gets off the hook a little easy, but he's Zeus. And he finds his love for Hera again. She's really excited. So in any medium, what is your favorite example of a couple reuniting? So I'll go first. I'm going to stay in comics. I'm going to cheat a little bit. And again, anybody who listens to my shows knows this. Hawkeye's maybe my favorite character ever. The 4-issue Hawkeye miniseries in the 80s by Mark Gruenwald is one of my favorite comics of all time.
That's a good one.
Yeah, and in that 4-issue mini, he meets Mockingbird for the first time, who's been a fringe character in the Marvel Universe. You know, has only had a few appearances, first as the Huntress, and then in one Marvel team-up issue as Mockingbird. They meet, they fight Crossfire, they get married by the end of the 4th issue. And then in Avengers West Coast, they're together, but they part at one point. She files for divorce. She's quote-unquote killed, but it's a Skrull who's replaced her, a la Secret Invasion. She returns in Secret Invasion, and they reunite. But one of the reasons I love her and I love him is they're not a good couple. They're incendiary. There's, like, you know, a lot of passion there, and they're fun while they last, but they are always going to implode. And there's something about a fiery, doomed romance that I just really love, especially in comics where they want everybody to get a happy ending. And so I love when they reunited after Secret Invasion, and I love that I knew that it couldn't last. So that's my choice. What about yours?
Mine, I'm going to TV, since I mentioned it before, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. It is Tara and Willow getting back together for the last time before, no spoilers, but something bad happens to Tara.
Yeah.
And I just love that little thing where she's talking about, like, Tara saying, like, things can't last forever. Problems can happen. She's like, you know, and sometimes it takes time to get back to that. But she's like, but at this moment, I don't care. Can you just be kissing me?
It's such a great moment.
Yeah.
And that's a great choice. I love Tara and Willow. And I again, no spoilers, but I'm still angry at what happens to Willow. Yeah. I mean, I'm not alone in that. You know, I get there's a generation of Buffy fans who are still angry about what happens to Willow. That is a great choice. Yeah, that's a really good choice. There's just something about a doomed romance, man, that really, you know, I don't know. It's I think comic book fans, we always love a something we know is not going to end happily. So Diana and the Amazons have a very important philosophical discussion after all of this, saying, well, now that we don't have to guard, you know, Doom's doorway anymore, and now that this era of punishment by the gods is over, we really do need to think about how do we spread our message, you know, and especially to man's world. And the Amazons are understandably tentative. They're like, look, every experience, regardless of how things just went with Heracles, every other experience we've had with men has been negative. Let's not jump into this. And for the first time, Hippolyta says, well, actually, we won't jump into it. We already have an ambassador to man's world. My daughter, I command you to go back to man's world and basically plant the seeds for the coming of the Amazons, or the connecting of the Amazons and man's world. And, you know, Hippolyta's always fought Diana leaving before and has always sort of fought against, you know, she's known its fate. She knows the will of the gods, so she didn't stop it. But she's never liked it. And this is the first time she's given her real approval of it. And she knows it's what's best for Diana. She knows Diana belongs to the world, not just to her. And she sends her home. So what were your thoughts on that moment?
I like the fact that they have this debate. I really like the one Amazon who says, I long for new students to teach. Still, I fear we tread on dangerous ground. I just love that concept. She's like, I want to have, like, I've taught you all for thousands of years.
I'm sick of you.
Okay, I'm done with you. You've learned this crap. There's nothing new to teach you. I have new students who can actually learn this for the first time. That's awesome. I love that. And I think I thought of you actually when I was reading that. I'm like, yeah, he probably did that. It's like, oh, could you imagine having the same students every year for the class? Eventually, like, they're going to just know it. You're just, like, bored. Mm-hmm. You're just like, we're doing page one. Hand it in when you're done. I'm going to have a drink and sit over here. Yeah, it's like, oh, new ones. Hopefully some of you will learn this too. Awesome. But it's like, yeah, but they're all violent, crazy people.
Yeah, it is.
One person's one thing. Can we pick this whole world on? But you can't do that. Like, I mean, the Queen's right. You can't do this whole thing and say, we stand for this better way No one can know it.
Yeah. Yeah, it really would be selfish of them to say, like, we believe in this philosophy and we've seen the power of it and we're just going to keep it to ourselves on this island. I mean, basically, it's Wakanda, right? Like, it, you know, from Marvel. And it's the same tension that exists in Wakanda. Should they share their gifts with the world, or will sharing with the world spoil what makes it special? And they're, again, Themyscira, the Amazons, are understandably tentative. They are talking about a complete shift in their culture after, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And Diana's the only one comfortable. And even she's like, she didn't spend a lot of time in man's world. I mean, she's, you know, been out a little bit, but not a ton, but she's excited to get back. And so she flies back, you know, sort of through the storm. She gets back to Julia and Vanessa Capitellis's, I don't, what, 10th home? I don't know. Julia Capitellis must be a Black Widow. I mean, she just, because she's a Harvard professor. She's not making that much money. She's either from old money, or as Brett Young will surmise in the comments, she is just marrying and killing dudes off and is embezzling money. And Brett is convinced that she's like a criminal. And, you know, I'm not so maybe unconvinced, because this is like her third home in the Boston area, all in the same area. And she flies back, and Vanessa and Julia welcome her back and say, you know, this is your home. And this really ends. The series could have ended here. You know, I mean, this is really a very natural ending point, but it really kicks off that, okay, this is the end of the Greek mythology portion of the story. Now let's get to some four-color superheroics, which I'm excited for. I've loved every bit of this, but I'm also excited to see Diana fight some supervillains. It'll be fun.
Interacting with the, you know, the quote-unquote real world.
Yes.
And also, I do like the transition as she leaves Paradise Island and you see the storms and the darkness is like, it goes from this nice bright blue sky of, you know, it's sunny and everything's beautiful, and she goes to night.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like a version, like, it's almost like indicative of what's to come. It's like, yeah, here there be monsters. You might have dealt with the ones there and everything's good now, but it's dark and stormy where you're going.
Yeah, I love that. I love that it's that's a really good read of that moment too. That it's like, hey, you're choosing this, and there's a joy and excitement in this, but it ain't gonna be easy.
Now, I have two questions for you.
Uh huh.
Because okay, first of all, so we get to the end, we see every, you know, the little to copyright Michael Bailey all subplots accounted for. You know, you see Mindy before we get to Julie. You know, the ending with Julie. You see Mindy. You see Etta and Steve on the plane. I have a quick question. How old is Steve? Because, I mean, from the story itself, it looked like, I would assume he's baby boomer, early baby boomer, born right after the war. But, like, this is 86, 87. It's only been, like, 42 years. Mm-hmm. So he can't be older than that. He looks like he's 60 or 70 years old.
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, the entire time, this entire show, we have talked about the choice that Perez makes and Potter, you know, the first writer, and then Ween continues to age Steve Trevor out of love interest for Diana, to make the age difference so drastic that they really can't be together and that you're not even really going to root for it. And so it opens the door for her to either not have any romantic interest or to have a bunch of, you know, different romantic interests. And so it is funny because I hadn't done the math really, but in this arc you're forced to, because she meets Steve's mom. She meets Diana Trevor. Yeah, and Diana says when Steve is born. And if you do the math from when the issue came out, you're right. He's only in like his 40s, like his mid-40s. And yet he's got crow's feet and wrinkles and he's gray. And I'm not saying somebody in their 40s can't have that. And definitely people looked older back then. I mean, you know, if you look at photos, but he is depicted as much older than he should be. I agree.
Yeah. So it's just something that really bothers me when I'm reading this. I'm like, how old is this guy? But the more important question is my final secret question.
Oh, okay.
So we get to at the end, as we've seen, both Heracles and Diana leave the world they're in. They go to another one. Heracles has left the underworld now, where he's been for thousands of years, possibly. And he goes back to Olympus. And Diana leaves her home on Themyscira to go to man's world. So if you were able to leave this world to go to another one, which other world would you choose to go to?
Ooh.
Now, since this is my question, I will go first. And this is actually something I've recently thought about, from something I recently read. So there's a Japanese manga, and now it's also an anime series, called 'Tis Time for Torture Princess.
That's a great title.
And I would go to that demon world there, because here's the premise of the whole series. The demon world and the human world are at war, and the princess, who's the leader of the, like, one of the armies for the human world, is captured by the demons, and she is, the whole series is her imprisoned, and being tortured for information. Here's the thing. The Demon World version of torture is, we're going to make food in front of you. Give us some kind of information, and you get to eat it. And look how yummy this is. And we don't really care. We're not looking for troop movements or secret weapons. You can just tell us what side of the bed the king likes to sleep on, and that's good enough for us. And I mean, the more you see of this demon world and the demon king, like the demon king looks like what you imagine a demon king look like, except like it's almost like Trigon. He has the big horns and everything, just not as many eyes. And he lives in like a regular house with his wife and kid. And like, they don't live in a mansion. Like they live in like, it looks like a house. Like they eat in the kitchen. You know, he takes a day off to go to his kid's field day for school. It basically like when he's told that there's invaders in the, you know, palace, you know, where he rules. And it's like, his first thought is it a lost child? Are they okay? It's actually a world where like, it's not trickle down economics. It's like trickle down empathy.
That's awesome.
But it works. But except this one works. It's like from the top up, it's like, what can we do to help each other and support our people that work, you know, support our people? What do they need? And it's like, wow, a world like that where it's actually coming from not just individual characters, but like the leadership down. Yeah, I would live there in a second.
That's amazing. That actually, I'm going to have to read that. That is amazing. So my daughter is super into manga and animes. I mean, just the way I'm into comics, she's into manga and anime. And I love the titles. Like there's the time I was reincarnated as slime. There's one, somebody's like the time I was reincarnated as a vending machine. I'm not getting the titles 100% right, but you know, and then there's like Toilet Bound Hanukkah-Con and Chainsaw Man and all these. I mean, the titles kill me and the premises do too, but that is amazing. That sounds awesome. I was watching an anime with her, something where there was this, it was like a Dungeons and Dragons one where this group was going down and down and down into a dungeon. And basically they would kill monsters and then they would have to eat them. And like they had a guy with them who was like a monster chef and he would like teach them how to prepare them well. It was such a weird show, but it did make me hungry. So
yeah,
that is a...
Yeah, this one will too, because the artist is amazing at drawing the food. It's like he spends most of his time, I think, on the food than the people. But yeah, like she's a prisoner there. She has a cell, but like, yeah, she has a bed with, you know, comforter and pillows and, you know, she has video games and, you know, phone and charger. And basically she's allowed to just wander around as much as she wants. There's no lock.
That is awesome. That is awesome. So this is a great question. I kind of have two answers. So as a kid, like many of us, I was addicted to the Narnia Chronicles, and I would have chosen Narnia in a minute. And then I actually tried Turkish Delight for the first time, and it tastes like gelatinous butt. It is so gross. It is the gross. The way they make Edmund describes it is the greatest thing ever in that book. And then I tried it and I was like, this book is lies. This book is all lies. So I would actually go to pre-crisis DC Universe. I think pre-crisis DC Universe, for all of the battles and different four-color action, was a place of hope and heroism. And it's a place where Barry Allen could get super speed and just become a hero because he liked the Flash comic books. And
yes,
you know, Will Payton like could get blasted by a blast from a satellite and choose to become a hero because that seemed like the right thing to do. And I really, I loved that. One of my favorite moments in JLA Avengers by Busick and Perez is when the Marvel heroes are astounded by the DC Universe because everybody loves the heroes there. There's the Flash Museum and Superman has this giant statue to him. And they're like, they actually like and support their heroes here. So I would want to be in pre-crisis DC because there's like super fun, silly shenanigans, but it's also a place of hope. So that's a great question, man. That's a great, great ending question. So this is the end of the first year, you know, 14 months, but the first year really of this book. And talk about a great piece of writing and art, obviously. And so speaking of art, did you have a favorite panel from the book?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's page 14, panel 3. It's Diana's flying and she's wearing basically the original Wonder Girl outfit.
Oh, yes. Good choice.
And it's a nice little nod to the old stuff. And I guess maybe it's also a little, I'm just thinking about it now, maybe it's a little nod to people saying, you know, for Perez saying, don't worry, we're going to figure out the Wonder Girl stuff eventually.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that obviously was a problem. But she just looks so damn happy there, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely like a companion piece to the cover. And yes, it's so funny because I, as closely as I read this, I did not notice it was the Wonder Girl outfit until you pointed it out. And I was like, oh my God, that is so smart. And you're right. It's got to be a tip of the cap. I mean, there's no Zany Haney here. You know, shout out to Billy, no. Billy D. No Zany Haney here to mess up continuity. Though, I mean, poor Donna Troy, you know, Crisis is just going to undo her completely.
It's and, just going to be a ending, never ending circle of redoing her origin over. I mean, as much as like the John Byrne stuff, he does it again.
Yeah, revamp after revamp after revamp. Donna Troy and the Legion, man, they never recover. So, yeah, it is a beautiful, beautiful panel. I went with page one, panel three. Page one is a series of three long panels. It's Diana flying back under Themyscira from Millennium. And that image of her, eyes wide open, mouth agape, surrounded by rubble, is just Perez 101. I mean, if you asked me, what is the archetypal Perez image? It's that. It's the Perez eyes, Perez emotion, and then rubble. So that was my favorite. Do you have an honorable mention?
I just realized I have two. The one real quick, the set page two and three, the double page spread, the stereotypical George Perez drawing every damn piece of rubble. As you know, the part of Diana flying in is Heracles is holding up the island, and it's all the individual rocks, and you could count each damn rock. But my honorable mention, and I think you're going to like this one too, is panel seven, page six, the big hairy man baby being held up by Diana. I'm going to see that damn thing in my nightmares.
It is really, it reminds me of when Arthur Adams draws Wolverine and takes the time to draw every hair.
Yes.
On his body. This is the same thing. It's Perez is like, look, he's Greek. He's a hirsute man. And look, as a fellow hirsute man, I appreciate it. But it is, it is a very carnal image, and it will, it's burned into my mind forever as well. So, you know, I mean, look, George wasn't afraid of a little nudity. If anybody listening has ever read Saxon Violence, you know, it's I think it's from Boom back in the early 90s.
Wasn't that Epic?
Oh, was it? Oh, God, no, you're right. It is Epic. You're right. Yeah. Boom. What am I thinking? Boom is 2000s. Yes, it was an Epic comic. It was definitely an interesting read. And George not pulling any punches in the art department. So that brings us to the end of the issue, but not quite the end of the episode. Because every episode ends with a segment I like to call Bringing Peace to Man's World. It's especially poignant in this issue where the Amazon Way has proven to redeem man and God alike. So in this segment, the guest and I each take about 30 to 60 seconds to talk about one way we would join Diana in her mission to bring peace to man's world. It can be silly, it can be funny, it can be serious, anything the guest or I want. So Al, since you're the guest, I want you to have the last word. So I'm going to go first. Okay. And so since this issue was focused on celebration, I'm going to stay in that lane. And this is a weird idea, but to bring a little peace to man's world, I think that every city and town should have a celebration Saturdays is what I would call them. And for this process, the city would have a nomination process, a methodology by which people could nominate citizens who are just great people. And it could be everything. It could be anything from like, hey, this person always recycles really well, to this person runs to the store for their elderly neighbor. This guy always lets people into traffic. You know, this person is, this kid, you know, has perfect attendance at school. Like, it could be anything. This kid's great at sports, or this person's kind to animals. Basically, a mechanism, a formal mechanism by which cities incentivize great behavior. Because on these celebration Saturdays, they would have these two people be surprised with a party. They'd have a party with all their friends. They'd have cake. They'd have, you know, balloons. They'd have a plaque declaring them great. They'd have a little cash prize to do something nice. And this is a way to incentivize the kind of behavior you want in a great society. So often, you know, if you watch TikTok, or if you're on Twitter, if you're any social media, you're going to see a million examples of people behaving badly. And we seem to like revel in that and celebrate it. And I would love a world where instead we revel and celebrate in behaviors we want to see. And we incentivize those behaviors by rewarding those people and making them exemplars. So I'm calling for celebration Saturdays in every city. What about you?
Nice. No sex in your relative's attic.
But Steve and Etta, what about Steve and Etta? What about VC That's, Andrews? Yeah. What about Flowers in the Attic?
No sex in your relative's attic. Your own attic is a different story. Relatives, no. Okay, maybe that's a minor way to bring peace. But actually, I thought of something based on also this issue in the whole, because I like the fact that it was like the gods were basically setting them up, Diana up, saying you have to do these trials. And when everything was over and everything was resolved, both the Amazons and the gods were celebrating it being over. They were both like, woohoo! it happened, it's finished, it ended well, let's all party. And I like that. So I'm thinking all wars or even just disputes between different groups, they should be settled by selecting a champion or champions from that group or country or whatever, and they compete in some way, whether it's an actual physical fight or there's some kind of competition, whether it's sports, they have to do their own trials, eating contest, whatever. And that's how it's resolved. That's how that problem is resolved. Not with everybody, just the champions. But when it's over, doesn't matter who wins. Everyone celebrates. You know, there's no you lost, we won, you suck. It's let's all party. You know,
I love
let's
it.
Get it. Now that it's over, everyone's happy. It's the problems are resolved. Let's celebrate.
That's awesome. It's like using the Olympics in place of war.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
Which I believe was something like, wasn't that supposed to be the purpose of it or something originally?
Yeah, it was supposed to definitely bring sort of peace to differing neighbors. And I do love, though, your addition of an eating contest. Because I, as somebody who will never be able to participate in Olympics and never would have been given the dearth of athletic gifts that I possess, an eating contest is awesome. Like, that would be so much fun to be nominated as your nation's champion. And it's like the blueberry pie eating scene from Stand By Me. That's amazing.
Literally what I was thinking of.
That's awesome. That is a great idea. I love it. That's a great way to bring peace to man's world. Well, Al, thank you so much for joining me today for this awesome issue. It's great to get to record with you again. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find your amazing shows?
Okay, so you can find my shows, both of them, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, which is, of course, all about Adam Warlock and Thanos and other cosmic type things. And That Giffen Show on the same feed. Basically, just type in Adam Warlock or Thanos, whatever podcatcher you use, it'll pop up. You can also find our page on Facebook. Just type in Adam Warlock or Thanos in the little searchy box and it'll come up. And we're on Blue Sky and X as at Adam Thanos Pod.
And I cannot recommend your shows enough. You guys are covering Silver Surfer Volume 2. And yes, you're right. You're like just before the Thanos stuff kicks in, right? You're at issue 40?
Yeah. 40. We just did like... that whole Silver Surfer goes to that Dynamo City thing, which is like 40 to 43. We just finished that. We're going to be actually recording the Thanos Quest miniseries.
Yeah, you're right on the brink of it. And so I loved that Silver Surfer series even before that. But man, when Ron Mars and Ron Lim join and take that book over and they kick it into Thanos Quest and the return of Thanos and then Infinity Gauntlet, Infinity War, all that stuff. I mean, that book is a classic of the late 80s, early 90s. And you guys are right on the precipice of covering those issues. So definitely tune in for that. It's a great show. And then if you're not familiar, the Giffen Show is so great. And if you're not familiar with the Keith Giffen Suicide Squad reboot, it is a ton of fun, has a lot of surprises, especially at the end of that series. And is great. And then, as Al said at the beginning of the episode, he and I will be covering the Heckler in the spring. And so it's definitely worth checking out. Well, thank you again, Al. And listeners, we're going to take a podcast promo break, and then we will be back with your feedback from issue 13 featuring Alex Orman.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos.
I think I shall call him Adam.
But return to me again empty-handed, and I will bathe the Starways in your blood.
Thanks, Dad. Sounds fair.
Korvac's power grows, as does his madness. He would have destroyed us all had I not pulled us into the Soul Gem.
Then Thanos, I'm coming for you.
After Xandar, you were going to kill my father?
You dare to oppose me?
You see what he has turned me into. You kill him, I will help you destroy 1,000 planets.
It's all right, Adam. We're here to help. Just stay cool.
I don't want to be here!
Resurrections, an Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast. 5 years and going strong. Every other week, mostly. For all of your Adam Warlock, Thanos, or Marvel cosmic needs. Find it on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever else podcasts are available. ResurrectionsAdamWarlock.tumblr.com.
Adam Warlock, You cannot keep leaving your philosophy books open on the floor. I always trip on them in the middle of the night on my way to the can.
We are back from that podcast promo break to cover your feedback for Wonder Woman issue 13, which I covered with my buddy Alex Orman. As always, I encourage you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and to leave feedback at fireandwaterpodcast.com as it helps folks to find the show. Up first is David Ace Gutierrez, who comments on Alex's crazy story from his Lasso of Truth segment, commenting simply, quote, kill a hobo, end quote, was not on my bingo card. Dag then comments on my story about filming a commercial for MTV Spring Break in the 90s, saying, so my buddy Sean has a story for each for every occasion. MTV? Covered. College meet cutes? Covered. Saved a cat? Probably. I'm inviting you all to all my dinners. P.S. I don't invite anyone over. Thanks, Dag. Yeah, I have some fun stories from my life, and I'm glad I have a place to share them. And nothing I've shared, though, compares to Alex's crazy tales of his youth that are right out of Goonies and Stranger Things. In fact, Al Sedano, the guest on this episode, wrote in to comment on Alex's Lasso of Truth story, saying, Alex's Lasso of Truth story was just amazing. I don't think any other one can top it or even come close. I really pity the poor sucker who has to try to follow that in the next episode. Well, Al, you did a great job. No need to be worried. But again, Alex's story is truly unique, as is Alex. Nate the Great writes in, continuing the commentary on the Lasso of Truth, saying, cool MTV story, Sean, though I thought all of those 1-800-COLLECT commercials had Alyssa Milano in them. This is Sean. Yeah, a lot of them did, and, you know, in a perfect world, I would have filmed that commercial and then gotten to meet Alyssa Milano, but, you know, alas. And Nate goes on to say, she was a great bad girl, even though Ange is right, and you can't go wrong with Tiffany Amber Thiessen either. I didn't think Wonder Woman had much to do with Millennium, which was a long, stupid Green Lantern crossover. Does everybody on this network hate Hal Jordan? Nate, that is a funny question. I don't hate Hal Jordan at all. He's just not in my top three, maybe four Green Lanterns. I'm a big Kyle Rayner fan. Love John, love Guy, love Cat Matui, love... maybe I do a little bit hate Hal Jordan, but I mean, that's not true. I have hundreds of issues of Green Lantern. So it is funny, though, how universally Hal gets replaced in the 90s by Kyle, and people loved Kyle, but there was that whole stupid Heat thing where people were trying to get Hal back, and then Geoff Johns comes along, brings Hal back, and then now this whole century people are like, yeah, Hal's okay. It just cracks me up. Network founder and host of MASHcast and Fade Out, Rob Kelly, writes in. Rob opens by talking about my secret question about a restaurant that makes you sick, but you just can't quit. And he says, I finally learned my lesson, but it took a couple of trips to Culver's, which I think might just be a regional chain, and getting a milkshake and suffering horrible stomach issues that I just gave up on them entirely. Yeah, Rob, this is Sean. Culver's is national. They have Culver's here as well. I have had their shakes. I've been fine with them, but I've never eaten their food, so maybe that's part of it too. Rob goes on mentioning a comment I made about starting a potential new show, jokingly, but maybe not, with Paul Kien called Shut Up and Read, where we cover comics that our parents gave us to get us to shut up and read. And he says, also, I would totally be up for a guest spot on the Shut Up and Read cast. I know I've mentioned this on other shows, but in the early 80s, my dad would occasionally go in the office on Saturdays and would buy me a bunch of comics where I would sit in the secretary's desk and read, giving him needed peace and quiet. Rob finishes by saying, Alex was a great guest. I agree. Previous guest Dr. Ange writes in saying, another fun episode and love those Hold the Lasso of Truth stories. This episodes were particularly compelling. Being on MTV commercial is hard to beat, but being involved in a drug/satanic/teacher-on-drugs/tropical-storm story beats it, hands down. Yeah, Alex's was impossible to top. Though, Dr. Ange, you still wear the crown for the best Lasso of Truth story in the history of the show. Ange goes on to say, I do love the ending of this arc, a triumphant story, and as you say, the Hercules moments are powerful given the grace of that the Amazons show. Now on to the secret questions. For food issues, Ange says, my girlfriend and I love Indian food and have a place where we give takeout from. I really love the lamb vindaloo. If I get it, quote, normal spicy, it isn't tasty enough for me. If I get it, quote, extra spicy, I love it, but it is like an express train working through my bowels. So whenever we order out, I have to make a value decision. Less satisfying meal, or there's an express train coming through. This is Sean. I love Indian food. I love Thai food. I love all kinds of food. Now, I'm Mexican, so you can give me the spiciest Mexican food on the planet, and I wave it off like it's nothing. But for some reason, Asian spicy kills me the same way, Dr. Ange, but I'm also the same way. I like spice. So Indian food, Thai food, almost any food from that part of the world, I do the same. I make the same mental calculus you make. Do I want to really love the meal but pay for it? Or do I want a little less satisfied meal? So I'm right there with you. Ange goes on to comment on my question about favorite bad girl. Now Ange really liked this question because he says, there are almost too many for me to list, unfortunately. Bad girl cartoon, Baroness from G.I. Joe. Bad girl movies, Xenia on a top from GoldenEye. Bad girl television, Valerie Malone from Beverly Hills 90210. But frankly, anything Tiffany Amber Thiessen is involved in is going to be high on the Dr. Ange list. Bad girl comic, Harley Quinn, probably in Full Jester, or deep cut Hyanthist. That's not a deep cut for you, Dr. Ange. Thanks for a great show, as always, Sean. Thanks for writing in, Dr. Ange. I love your list. I also have always had a soft spot for the Baroness. Tim Price, host of The Outcasters on the Right On Network, writes in saying, Hippolyta is the standout of this issue. Instead of solely being, quote, the queen from pre-crisis, she's every bit the warrior Diana is, but balanced with a superhuman level of compassion. I don't remember the specifics of next issue, but I hope there will be a reckoning with Hercules in some fashion. Though there definitely was, Tim. Tim goes on to say, well, for my podcast, which is The Outcasters, you should listen to it. That was Sean. Tim says, I finally reread Millennium. I found my physical copy since DC Infinite is no help. Man, it's an editorial mess, so I feel for you, Sean. The sacrifices we make for our audiences. But I think Diana got more panel count than the Outsiders, so you win on that score. Is that a win, Tim? I don't know that more time in Millennium is a win for anybody, really. Tim goes on to say, for some reason, when Sean started talking about food regrets, I was thinking of Fuddruckers, which is the restaurant I mentioned, which is hilarious, even though I rarely got their chili fries. I just love their burgers and can't recall being sorry afterwards, so I can't explain why my thoughts anticipated Sean's answers. Stay out of my head, Sean. Oh, I guess the closest answer for me in these years is when I would get Taco Bell. Overdoing that could lead to problems. A favorite bad girl has to be Amora the Enchantress. That era when she and Thor were a couple was crazy, but can you blame him? Co-sign me for Diamondback and Black Cat, obviously. But an interesting twist was when Ultimate Spider-Man met the universe's Black Cat. She was amazing, completely into Peter, but she was an adult, and Peter was still in high school. Now, she didn't know that at the time. So when she unmasked him, she Ralphed on the spot. I forgot about that, Tim. She really does. That's so funny. Yeah, I thought it's hilarious, but poor Peter. That has to hurt your self-esteem. Great episode, as always. Thanks, Tim. Super Captain writes in saying, excellent show, Sean and Alex. Sean, I believe you mentioned the symmetry of the arc of the first woman who was murdered in issue one being brought to completion with Hippolyta's merciful suffering for Hercules when bound together by Diana's lasso. That has echoes of the Christian notion of Christ as the second Adam who comes to redeem the first Adam, humankind, by graciously suffering with us and reconnecting or rebinding us to God. Sorry to get all theological on you, but I am a pastor. That's never a problem, Super Captain. I love these little lessons. I think it's fascinating, and I do think there's so much, you know, religious imagery and there's so many religious overtones to this book that I really appreciate your commentary on that. Super Captain goes on to say, on to the secret question, food issues. I've been a vegetarian for 30 years or so now, but I remember well a birthday when we went to McDonald's in the closest largest city about an hour away and had my first and only McRib. Oh, then we went to an arcade back in my hometown and I started feeling sick. The second that I got home, I quickly darted to the bathroom where I spent most of the night. Whenever they bring the McRib back for a limited time, I could barely watch the commercials. Super Captain, I am right there with you. I am so disgusted by everything about the McRib, the shape of it, which is not a shape found in nature, the smell of it, the look of it, the commercials alone make me gag. But I have a friend who I've been friends with since my freshman year of high school. We met my third day on the school bus, and he is obsessed with McRib. And to this day, though we live states apart, he will text me whenever the coming of the McRib is announced each year. He will text me that it's coming, and then he will text me a picture of his first McRib of the year and him eating it and his satisfied smile. And each time I'm like, oh my God, this is so disgusting. So I totally feel your pain. Super Captain goes on to say, I'm not usually a big fan of the bad girls, but I will offer these as favorites. Diamondback from Mark Gruenwald's Captain America run. I second that. Baroness from G.I. Joe, as mentioned by Dr. Ange. And Regina, a.k.a. the Evil Queen, played by Laura Perea in Once Upon a Time. My wife has become a fan of the TNT series Leverage, and if she counts as a bad girl, the character of Sophie Devereaux, as played by Gina Bellman, would be able to make the list. She is a grifter, a thief, and quite beautiful to boot. Congratulations on the 1 year anniversary of the podcast. My wife and I still make time to listen together each month. Oh, that's awesome. Thank you. Thank you for noting the anniversary. That actually passed without me even noting. I didn't realize it until I read your comment. I went, oh my gosh, it has been a year. So thank you. And thank you. And thank you, Mrs. Super Captain, for listening. That means a lot. And for writing him. As always, Bucky749 brings in the rear with secret questions asking, it being close to Thanksgiving, which movie would you show Wonder Woman, her mom, and the Amazons to explain American Thanksgiving? Number one, Charlie Brown. Number two, Alice's Restaurant Massacre Meal. Three, or the Rugrats Thanksgiving Special. I'm always going to go with Rugrats on that because they're the only cartoon who's ever done a Hanukkah special. So I gotta, you know, stand for my peeps. Bucky's second question is, who would introduce the Amazons to pro wrestling, and which event would you have them watch? Now, David Ace Gutierrez beats me to this by mentioning Rhea Ripley as the introduction, and she's perfect. I mean, if there is an Amazon on Earth, that there is a modern-day Themyscirian amongst us, it's Rhea Ripley, so I 100% agree with that. And actually, I would introduce the Amazons to WrestleMania from a couple of years ago. I don't remember the number, but it's the one where Cody Rhodes finally beats Roman Reigns to win the belt, and it kind of concludes Cody Rhodes' story coming back from AEW, and it's, I think, the best WrestleMania ever. So great questions, Bucky. Thanks for asking. I love the comment sections of this show. It's the only show where we get everything from, you know, Christ redeeming Adam to Fuddruckers to Rhea Ripley and WrestleMania. So thank you, everybody who listens. Thank you, everybody who wrote in. Again, this is my favorite part of the show. I so appreciate you all listening, you know, to my silly show and writing in with your comments, which are always amazing. Thank you so much for doing that each month. I hope you enjoyed this episode with my guest, Al Sedano. And join me next month, where we try to bring a little bit of peace to man's world.